So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, Chapter 5, Text 33. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Yogena Bhakshitam Nabha Navasonushvitam Sparsham Vakurvam Nirmame Nilam Kala.
Time.
Maya.
External energy.
Amsha Yogena.
Partly mixed.
Bhagavat.
The personality of Godhead.
Vikshitam.
Glanced over.
Nabha.
The sky.
Navasa.
From the sky.
Anushritam.
Being so contacted.
Sparsham.
Touch.
Vikurvat.
Being transformed.
Nirmame.
Was created.
Anilam.
The air.
Translation
and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, the personality of Godhead glanced over the sky, partly mixed with eternal time and external energy, and thus developed the touch sensation from which the air in the sky was produced. All material creations take place from subtle to gross. The entire universe has developed in that manner. From the sky developed the touch sensation, which is a mixture of eternal time, the external energy, and the glance of the personality of Godhead. The touch sensation developed into the air and the sky. Similarly, all other gross matter are also developed from subtle to gross. Sound developed into sky, touch developed into air, form developed into fire, taste developed into water, and smell developed into earth. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Jatapadukam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Shcha Shri Rupam Sadrajatam Sahagana Raganitam Vitam Dam Sajivam Sadaitam Savadutam Bharijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shcha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Smaramaniti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Vodavane Pacharine Nivishesha Shunyavadi Pashtamsha Desha Tamane. No, don't touch it. Don't touch it. So, the scientists have another version. They say it all came out of nothing. But that's gross ignorance. Where is there an experiment where you can get something out of nothing? Anybody ever done such an experiment? Has any scientist ever taken nothing and gotten something out of it in the laboratory? It's never been done. But yet, they are pushing for this dogmatic principle that everything has come out of nothing. And they're accusing us of being dogmatic by understanding that there's a source for everything. They say that existence is sourceless. We say it is sourceful. That's the difference. They say there's no source for existence, it just comes out of nothing. We say there is a source for existence. Govindam adipurusham tamaham vijami. So, who's actually correct? How will we discern what is correct and what is incorrect? We can use some common sense. That's all. We've never seen that you can get something out of nothing, but we see every day you get something out of something. So therefore there has to be an original something. It can't, the original, the origin can't be nothing. It has to be something. This is common sense. So what they call science is not even sensible from the standpoint of common sense. An ordinary man, you see, can understand you don't get something out of nothing. But yet in the name of so-called science, they want to tell us that everything comes out of nothing. And then the second conclusion is, everything comes out of nothing and you're just a machine. That's the next point. You're not even a person, you're just a machine. Just a bunch of chemical. You're not really a you. You just think you're a you. But who's thinking that they're a you? There's no you there. Is it? It doesn't make any sense. It's pure garbage dogma, that's all it is. Modern day, what they call modern day science is dogma. So we are not going to be misled by popular votes because everybody thinks the scientists are great. Therefore we're going to just follow them blindly. We reject these so-called scientists. One songwriter, he said, I saw the great blunder my teachers had made, scientific delirium madness. So this is the great blunder of the modern day civilization. They put their faith in these mental speculators who say that they know what is the truth. This is everywhere, it's being put forward as gospel. Evolution is considered a fact. Even though this has never been proven by anybody, it's considered a fact. If you don't believe it, you're considered some old-fashioned religious sentimentalist. You see, this is a modern-day society. So, we have to see the fallacy of these things. We have to be convinced that there is a source for existence. Prabhupada says that our philosophy is substance. Their philosophy is there is no substance. Our philosophy is there is a substance. Reality is substantial. It's based on something. It's not based on nothing. So then what is the nature of that something, one could ask? And say, okay, I accept that there was something out there that it's the source of all existence. There's a something there. What is the nature of that something? The impersonalists say it's the Brahman, the impersonal Brahman. So is that acceptable from a logical viewpoint? Of course, scripturally we reject it, but logically, is that principle acceptable? There is an impersonal Brahman that's the source of everything. Let me give you a simple example. If every day I bring you a quantity of gold as a gift, you say, wow, this is great. Where are you getting all this gold from? Well, we got a gold mine. Just bringing you some gold out of our gold mine. Well, really, how much gold is in that gold mine? Oh, there's no gold in the gold mine. That wouldn't make any sense, would it? There has to be gold in the gold mine if you're getting gold out of the gold mine. So, the original source is the existential mine, if you were. The existential mine. And from that existential mine, so many persons are coming out. I'm a person, you're a person. What's the proof? If I call you if I tell you you're not a person, you'll be offended. I tell you you're just a machine, you'll be offended by them. That proves that you're a person. You see? You're just a machine. You're not really a person even. There's not even a you there. It's just some machine going through its gyrations. You see, you'll be offended. That proves that you're a person. So I know that I'm a person. You know that you're a person. So where do all these persons come from? The original source is no personality. How can you get persons out of an impersonal existential mind? How can you get gold out of a goldless gold mine? If there's gold coming out of the gold mine must possess gold. Similarly, if persons are coming out of that original source must indeed possess personality. And if it possesses personality, is it an it? No. If it has personality, it's not an it. It's a person. So now we've understood simply through simple, clear logic, without following any dogmatic propaganda. We've understood that the original source of existence is a person. So the next question is, okay, then why do we exist? That origin, we understand from the scriptures that original person wants to expand his own enjoyment. And Prabhupada gives the example, Chanakya Pandit, he says that a home without children is a desert. So Krishna doesn't want to live in a desert, so he expands from himself all these living entities so he can have so many wonderful varieties of loving relationships with all of his devotees. That's why we exist. Simply to expand the loving happiness of Krishna. He expands out from himself, us, an unlimited number of jiva souls with whom he can have an unlimited number of sweet, loving relationships. Therefore, if we are not in a loving relationship with Krishna, that's an aberration or a deviation from the way things are meant to be. Is it? We are meant to be in a loving relationship with Krishna because that's why we exist. And if you're not in your natural position, it's like a fish out of the water. Can the fish be satisfied on the land? Is it possible? Can you give him a very nice facility? Give him a nice easy chair? Or give him a cigar? Can he be happy? Not possible. For that fish to be happy, he has to be back in his original natural environment. So the living entity, to be happy, has to be back in his original natural relationship with that Supreme Person. So that is the whole point of this Krishna consciousness movement. It is to educate, train, guide, inspire, and facilitate persons coming back to their original natural consciousness. Our purpose is not to start some religious organization, to get some buildings, to have some projects. Those are external aspects. But the actual purpose of our movement is to reconnect the living entities who have forgotten their relationship with God, with Krishna. It is to reconnect those living entities who are suffering in this material existence with their original position, with their original loving Lord, Sri Krishna, in any one of his unlimited number of forms. There is the original planet of Krishna Loka, and there are also the Vaikuntha planets. Some devotees have a relationship with Krishna in the Vaikuntha realm, not in his original form of Krishna. So, according to one's nature, according to one's consciousness, one serves Krishna either in Krishna Loka or in one of his expanded forms in Vaikuntha Loka. They're all liberated souls. They're all perfected spiritual beings. And we are meant to be back in our relationship with Krishna, or in one of his expanded forms, in his eternal pastimes in the spiritual world. Our sojourn here was a deviation from our actual duty, a deviation from our actual nature. So now, instead of being deviated, we need to get back on the track. Somehow we got sidetracked somewhere along the line with some idea of enjoying independently from Krishna. So such foolish thinking has to be rejected, completely rejected, with proper intelligence. Because unless you have proper intelligence, how will you keep your mind under control? You have to have proper intelligence based on the Vedic wisdom. And then when your intelligence is strong, fixed in Vedic understanding, then you can discipline your mind as the mother trains the child. You can keep your mind always controlled and fixed. And you can see when your mind is going off the track, and you can get it back on the track. And then gradually by training that mind, becomes, instead of the enemy, which it is at the present time, that mind, once it is fixed in Krishna consciousness, becomes the best friend of the living being. So I can ask now if there's some questions. Oh, they're already here. Okay. Krishna fulfilled my desire. Yes.
How do we explain when we read the verse, should we be able to hear you? I should speak loudly.
Speak loudly, yeah.
When we read the verse, we understand that sky or space is coming from God, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, we, at least from a mundane point of view, we understand that space is surrounding everything, and therefore a mundane may see God as part of space. You know, like he takes some, he's got a form in his position in space.
Let me turn up the volume on my hearing aid. I'm missing about half what you're saying.
Maybe I should come.
Why don't you come up here, yeah? Because I'm dealing with a defective body here.
Yeah. You know, the mundane people, usually when we talk about God, can you hear me now? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So for them, they perceive, they think we understand God as a limited person, and they see space as greater than God. They think God fits into space rather than space.
So they don't understand that Krishna is everything, and everything is Krishna also. Krishna is in one place, and at the same time he's everywhere, because actually everything that exists is Krishna in the form of his energy. There's nothing that exists except for Krishna in one sense.
So even space is...
Everything that exists is... there is nothing in existence except for Krishna and his energy. So everything is actually Krishna in that sense. It's the expanded form of Krishna is energy. There's nothing exists except for Krishna. There's nothing exists outside of Krishna. Everything exists within Krishna. Yeah. So they can't understand. They think God in a very limited way. They don't understand God in an unlimited way. The Vaishnava philosophers understand God in an unlimited way. So they can't understand God in an unlimited way, therefore they think that God is impersonal. But we can understand how the person can be in one place and every place all at the same time. Ekopyasa rishabhitam jagananda kotim yachchakta rashti jagananda jayayananta andantadasta paramanu chayantadastam Govindamadi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. He's an undifferentiated entity, as there is no distinction between potency and the possessor thereof. In his words, work of creation of millions of worlds, his potency remains insufferable. All the universes exist in him, and he is present in his fullness in every one of the atoms that is scattered throughout the universe at one and the same time. Such is the primeval Lord of Mayadhura. You see? So actually nothing exists outside of Krishna. Krishna is within everything, everything is within Krishna. So Krishna is completely unlimited. At the same time, he's sitting on the bank of Jamuna with his cowherd boyfriend, he's popping a gulab jamun in his mouth. He's not limited by being unlimited. He can be unlimited at the same time he can be in one place having a wonderful, loving relationship with his devotees. That's the inconceivable, unlimited potency of the Supreme Person. Okay? Does that make it a little more clear? Okay. Okay, let's see here. What? Yes, Prabhu.
My question is, why is the living entity as Brahman described as impersonal when we know that the living entity actually has form?
Why? Where is the living entity described as impersonal? I don't follow.
The Brahman feature is described.
Why is the Brahman impersonal? Krishna says, there never was a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. Certainly the person, the personal nature of the jivas is stated by Krishna. It is stated. There was never a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings. That's very personal. But as far as, but the question is then, why is the Brahman impersonal?
Yes.
Right. That's right.
It's made up of all of these personalities.
Huh.
Right?
Yes.
And
that's right. And yeah, it's interesting because that's right. So why is it impersonal if it's constituted of all the living entities? Is that what you're asking? In other words, the Brahman means the effulgence of the Lord, but actually we make up that effulgence, right? Is that what you're asking? Yeah. So the Brahman is compared to the rays of the sun, and Krishna is compared to the sun globe. So if we actually constitute that we and all the other things that emanate from Krishna constitute the impersonal Brahman, why are we considered to be persons, or why is that considered to be impersonal? Or both? Yeah.
We see that the elements of creation are actually fitting the senses of the living entity.
They're doing what?
Fitting. They're being manifest from sensual activity, the five senses.
Yeah, they're coming out. That's right. We're seeing, for example, form develops into fire,
yeah.
Touch develops into air, etc.
Yeah, so it's all related to
from subtle to gross.
Yeah, it's related to a person having senses, right? So that indicates there's a person behind everything. Yet we see the Brahman aspect is emphasized as being impersonal. I don't think if we have a personal philosophy, why is that impersonal aspect emphasized?
If we have a personal philosophy, why is the impersonal aspect of Brahman being emphasized?
It just occurred to me, it was something that popped into my head this morning while I was walking around. It was something that popped into my head
Yeah.
this morning while I was walking around the lake. So when I come out, I try to see the living, I try to, at least in my mind's eye, see the living entity and see the super soul present. And I think, the super soul's a person, so why can't I see the, you know, why don't I see the person?
Well, actually, the devotee does learn how to see the person. Even if the person is impersonal, he sees, he's manifesting an impersonal nature due to his being covered by the modes of nature. Actually, every single living entity is a pure devotee of Krishna who has a svarupa. Every devotee has his own personal, intimate relationship. Every jiva soul is actually a devotee. And every jiva soul has his own intimate personal relationship with Krishna. It's simply covered right now. So the material world is a very, very impersonal place. It's a fact because people don't actually come out and be who they are. They're being manipulated to play different false roles by the influence of the modes of nature. It's like Shakespeare said, life is but a stage, and the poor player struts and frets his hour upon the stage and is no more. Nobody's actually being who they are. That's why it's so impersonal here. Nobody's being who they are. Everybody's simply playing these false roles. That's why two people can't connect with each other. That's why there's divorces going on like crazy. There's no connection between the actual people. So this Krishna consciousness movement is really the only thing that can bring happiness back to the human society. Because we're teaching people how to be who they really are. How to stop trying to play all these false roles where you think you're the center of the universe, which is just a false dream. Come back to the actual position of being a subordinate servant of the Supreme Person and seeing everything in relation with Him and engaging everything in His service. Does that help a little bit? We have to see from the standpoint of somebody who's the person who's Brahman realized what is his consciousness. He wants to see, he doesn't want to see anything beyond the oneness, the eternity aspect of the Supreme. He just wants to see the oneness. He wants to think that he's the Supreme. So this philosophy, Brahman, this impersonal Brahman philosophy, is very attractive to someone who wants to think that they're the Supreme. Actually, it was propagated as a way to defeat atheism, to bring back in Vedic culture. Buddhadev had turned India into a Vedic, into an atheistic civilization. Completely atheistic. Buddhism is atheistic philosophy. So, how do you convince an atheist to believe in God? My dear atheist, sir, if I told you that you were God, maybe you could you maybe believe in God? Well, if I get to be God, yeah. All right. Yeah, I can believe in God. You see, so it's a way of sneaking Vedic culture back in. You tell the atheist, you're all God. Yeah. All right. I accept it. So in this way, but it was done, he did it, Shankaracharya's trick was to use the Vedanta Sutra to do that by very, very elaborate, sophisticated word jugglery. He was able to bring back Vedic culture, so-called, a shadow of Vedic culture. And then from the shadow, then the whole series of Vaishnava Acharyas, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Vishnu Swami, Nimbarka, culminating in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then brought in the full-fledged Vaishnava culture, the original culture of India, and was brought back. So the impersonal philosophy is very attractive to a certain class. And it also, even in practical terms, in the modern day society, it has, in some ways, it's good. Just like now, there's all this sectarianism going on. You have,
one group of Muslims beheading another group of Muslims, you know, for example. Even within one faith, there's sectarianism. So the impersonal philosophy is attractive because it says all religion is one. It's attractive in that way. And many people, what's it called? Spirituality nowadays is basically Mayavadi philosophy. It's part spirituality. People say, I don't want to belong to religion, but I'm into spirituality. You see, it's my body. So they just want to see, they want to go and meditate on the sunrise, and they want to try to love everyone's spirituality. So there's some benefit to come out of a gross sectarian concept, to come into some idea of the universality of religion. It's good, but it's incomplete. Because it tends to make one very, very proud. Just like I remember I studied one book. It was called The Book by Alan Watts. He said, actually, you were God. But right now you're just playing hide and go seek with yourself. So come out of hiding and be God again. That's it. So, that aspect of it is crazy. And it just defeats the whole purpose of how to become humble before the Lord once again and submissive to His will. So we have to, Lord Chaitanya accepted the good aspect of that. There's thesis that God is, there's God in the living entity. There's duality. That's the thesis. And then the antithesis that, no, they're one. God is one, not two. It's a unity. There's duality is the thesis. The antithesis is just pure unity. And then the synthesis is simultaneous oneness and difference of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is a very profound... In the history of philosophy, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the culmination of philosophical evolution. To understand the simultaneous oneness and difference of the Absolute Truth. We understand the oneness. I mean, Lord Brahma stated it very clearly in that verse I quoted earlier. He is an undifferentiated entity. There's no distinction between potency and the possessor thereof. That means actually everything is Krishna in one sense. So that's the Mayavadis go, yeah, right on. You see, but then at the same time, there is that distinction. So, yeah, it's a very deep subject matter, and the more we get into it, the more it becomes thrilling and exciting, actually, to go beyond the our impersonal tendencies of wanting to think that we are God, and actually realize that the part and parcel of the Supreme, although one with the Supreme, is quantitatively different. The drop of ocean water is qualitatively exactly the same as the ocean in quality. The chemical composition of the drop is exactly the same as the entire ocean. Quantity, there's a gulf of difference. You can float a cruise ship in the ocean, but not in the little drop. So maybe that helps shed some light on that. Yeah?
Thank you for the class. If chanting Hare Krishna is so simple and sublime, why is it so hard?
If chanting Hare Krishna is so simple and sublime, why is it hard? It's not hard. We make it hard. It's the most simple, natural thing. But we make it hard because we have these, we got all these anarta there. The lust, the anger, the greed. It's the most wonderful thing, the sweet holy names. There's unlimited nectar oozing out from these two syllables, Krishna. To swim in it. Chanting Hare Krishna means swimming in an ocean of unlimited nectar. But we're sitting on the bank wondering, it looks a little cold, I don't think I can. The pure devotees that are relishing this ocean of nectar, saying, come in, the water is fine. And we're going, well, I don't know, it looks a little chilly to me. So we'll take some of these. Let's see, anybody from the internet has asked a question here. We got some people tuned in from the internet. Let's see here. Here's a question coming in from Christchurch. Why is it the scientists who have a logical mind, they cannot understand the simple logic of intelligent design in the material world? Because they have a motive. They're very expert at word juggling, but they actually have a motive. They want to establish. You see, if you come in with your own preconceived idea, then you cannot really, you're closed-minded. You can't really understand when things are presented. If you come in with your own preconceived idea that you're trying to push forward your own agenda, you may have a very sophisticated agenda, but as long as you're trying to push forward your own agenda, then what you can hear? They have a preconceived idea. They say they're open-minded, but actually they're dogmatists. They're not open-minded investigators. They have their dogma that there was a big bang and, you know, there was a chunk or whatever they have to say nowadays. They have their dogma and they're pushing for their dogma. So they can't understand. Until you become truly open-minded, humble, submissive, I don't really know, please enlighten me. You see, then you can actually begin to understand. You come a completely open book, completely clear out all your preconceived ideas and hear from one who has realized in the absolute truth, and then it makes all the sense in the world. But as long as you come in wanting to make your own point, you see, then you can't really learn. If chanting is simple and sublime, on paper, yeah. Why people are suffering in this world? Simply due to ignorance. We think we're these bodies. The body is in an ignorant position. But the self is beyond all suffering because we identify with these bodies, therefore we suffer. With certain devotees, I am naturally not able to connect due to different natures. Well, that's your material nature. Someone who's a pure transcendentalist knows the art of connecting with everyone. We use many gadgets like laptops, mobile phones, etc., which are the product of development of science and technology. Do you say that scientists, researchers who develop this are dogmatic? And is this garbage knowledge because we use these in Krishna's service also? We have no objection to using modern-day technological gadgets. I'm certainly using my share. Right here I'm going on the internet, using a laptop computer to broadcast this lecture all over the world. We're certainly not against, because somebody can develop can manufacture a computer or a smartphone doesn't mean they know the origin of existence. Just because somebody can razzle-dazzle you with a cool smartphone doesn't mean they know the origin of existence. My mind is constantly battling with my fears, and these fears are draining me. I want to overcome them, but how? Abhichadam. Take shelter, become fearless by taking complete shelter of Krishna. My dear Lord, now I fully submit myself to you. Do whatever you want to with me. Just let me always remain in your shelter. Then there's no fear. How to help someone develop faith in the scriptures if they're very new to Krishna consciousness? You have to have faith in the scriptures. And then your faith will rub off on them. How to rectify criticizing devotees? Well, you're a criticizing devotee. I can see that. Rectify yourself, and then they'll follow your example. How much important is it to closely interact and reveal each other's hearts when mixing in the vicinity of devotees? We need to have some devotees. Not that you go around revealing your heart to everyone, but
You need to find certain devotees you can really fully open your heart to. It's not that you just go around, you know, blabbing to everybody all your personal things, you know, in the Bajari room, you know, wherever, just going around blabbing all day long about what's going on, you know. But you need to find certain devotees where you can actually reveal what you're going through and get their advice on how to advance. You have to choose your associates wisely, those who can actually are qualified to actually help you. I met a couple of guests recently who started learning about the process but left learning and practicing because of the Bhagavad Gita principle, no illicit sex. What should my suggestion have been? Well, that depends on the individual. And, you know, this, it's hard to make a blanket statement because it depends. You have to give those people a vision of how Krishna consciousness is so wonderful. It's so wonderful that any sacrifice that you have to make is worth it. It's a fact that sex pleasure is the number one pleasure in the material world, confirmed by the Bhagavatam. Maitunadi, Bhagavatam says. Maitun means sexual intercourse. Adi means it's the number one thing. Maitun adi, grihamedi sukham. But Bhagavatam says he tu cham. It's actually insignificant. It's 10th class. So the thing is, we're in a society where everybody is, you know, sex is their only pleasure. They work so hard, and struggling in the workplace, struggling, and then light, they get a little sex pleasure, a little enjoyment for a few seconds, you see. But we have to teach them that actually, by regulating their sex and using it only for producing children for Krishna, that they can actually achieve an enjoyment which surpasses the pleasure of sex millions and billions of times. So just like Prabhupada, I remember he said about LSD. In the early days, the devotees were all LSD voyagers at 26 Second Avenue. They're all coming off LSD. And so Prabhupada said in one lecture, he said, "So, do you think LSD is a very wonderful thing?" And they were all thinking, "Oh, probably thinking, oh." Prabhupada said, "This Hare Krishna, it is like a whole room full of LSD." So, you think sex is a very nice thing? "Oh yeah, I love it." "Well, we're going to give you something much better than sex. Much more pleasurable than sex." "Really? Better than sex? Tell me about it." You see? So in this way, it depends on who you're talking to, but we have to have this conviction that sex is 10th class, there's something better than sex where you can be relishing greater pleasure than sex 24 hours a day. Sex is a heavenly pleasure, there's no doubt. It's like being a demigod for a few seconds. But this pleasure is beyond the pleasure of the demigods. It puts their pleasure to shame. The pleasure that's tasted by one who is actually mature in chanting Hare Krishna, and sex doesn't even come close to the pleasure and ecstasy that he's feeling at every second. So we have to have that conviction, and then you have to judge according to that particular person's mentality how to present it in such a way that will turn them on. You see, that's what you have to see. You have to tailor fit your presentation to that particular person, not just some, you know, spout off some mantras. You have to tune into that person. I saw that quality in Vishnu Janaswami. Prabhupada said, because he is personally a very nice devotee, he's made many nice devotees. So you have to be a very wonderful, loving, kind-hearted person. And you have to manifest that loving kindness in your dealings with people. And that way, you can help them to go beyond their material attachments. Well, unfortunately, well, actually, we have our time is up. But we do have a whole stack of questions which will come to tonight's program. At 7:30, we're having a program here. And so we'll continue these questions. Come tonight to hear the answers to your questions. Even more. Okay, we had a big... Probably we just have a question and answer session tonight. It's all because we got so many questions here waiting to be answered. So we thank you all very much. We're actually very delighted to be here in this wonderful temple. A holy tirtha of Srila Prabhupada's transcendental lila. We feel very blessed to be here and to see how you all are taking very nice care
to maintain and expand the Krishna Consciousness Movement in Melbourne. So we thank you very much for your blessings and your association. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Disgrace to Krishna Das.